in venues where they can surround the place, they will. And they will use, megaphones, bullhorns, pots and pans, drums, and just try to drown you out for the next 3 hours. It's relentless.
Coming up on British Thought Leaders, Charlie Bentley Astor talks about her secret mission to support free speech in university.
You can hear the sort of mob coming. That was quite an intimidating night.
Charlie went undercover to prevent the cancellation of controversial speakers like Jordan Peterson and Kathleen Stock.
Because when I was hanging out in these group chats, I saw them planning how they were going to try and take us down from start to finish.
Did you feel safe all the time?
No. Right. No, but that's not a priority.
Charlie talks about Oxbridge secret societies meeting to resurrect free speech and conservative thought.
These things aren't heretical, they aren't radical. They're what we were all talking about in the common room of the university up until about 2010. And so it's reviving that traditional university culture.
Welcome to British Thought Leaders, I'm Lee Hall. Today I'm sitting down with writer and commentator Charlie Bentley Astor. Charlie, thanks for joining us.
No, thanks for having me.
We've had several guests on talking about cancel culture in universities from the academic point of view. This is the first time we've had someone talking from the student side. Can you give us a brief background of your academic history and how you got involved in supporting free speech?
So I grew up going to state schools, and I think that actually has a bearing on the conversation around free speech at universities, because you receive a more liberal, progressive education than you perhaps do at private schools. And my name is a big misnomer, Bentley Astor. People think that I went to private school, but I've got a very working class background. So by a very strange set of miracles, I ended up at Cambridge University, where I studied Bachelor's of English between, 2019 and 2023, so I graduated July last year. And how was I involved in the free speech stuff? Whenever a speaker would try and come to the university that, you know, has something of a reputation outside of the university, normally from a right-wing perspective, people like Helen Joyce, Kathleen Stock, Jordan Peterson, when they came to try and speak and protests would be mounted, I would try and do things behind the scenes to make sure that those events went ahead rather than get cancelled.
So how did people hear about the cancellation happening? How did word spread around and what kind of thing would happen?
So normally begins with someone, normally a student, complaining on Facebook that right. XYZ has been invited to speak at their college, their faculty. Then another student would pipe up and go, "That's outrageous. I can't believe that the college, the faculty is letting this happen." That they would let, you know, these, then, you know, epithets start getting thrown around. These bigots have been invited. These Nazis have been invited. How can they tolerate this? So then they will start sort of a campaign of letter writing to their faculties, the committees within their colleges. So the LGBT society will mount their own letter with the protesters and normally send that to the head of the college with the expectation that the college will get startled, back down, give an apology and cancel the talk.
Right.
And then, so that's more like the public side of things that takes place on Facebook, but then there's the private, and so that side of it becomes more public when things like the student newspapers are always sympathetic to the protesters rather than the speakers. Mm-hmm. And so we'll publish a spate of articles decrying the speaker and sort of alluding to the idea that anyone who goes is in fact inculcated in all their views and therefore is also a bigot and a transphobe and a homophobe and all the rest of it. And then if that really kicks off and the colleges do start giving response letters to these protesters, that sometimes makes the national newspapers, which we saw in the case of Helen Joyce, because we had the master of Gonville and Caius College actually put that letter out saying that, I can't remember the exact quote, but it's something like, we don't want hateful people on site. But then the sort of private side of it is group chats of these organisers of these protests. And I had several different SIM cards, which I was switching out of my phone, so that I could be in these group chats to see what was being said and what was being planned and the style of the protests and how many people and where and when. So that's where it's organised, and I would take that information and usually go to the organisers of these events and going, look, you're going to need this, this and this, because they're planning this, this and this.
It's like a kind of James Bond stuff almost.
Yeah, I mean, it felt, it was sort of a no-brainer for me to be doing that. And it does, and with the sort of, we'll get to this, but sort of the secret societies that go on in counteraction to all of this stuff and these talks, it does feel very romantic. And one of my friends even described it as quite sexy, all this espionage that goes on with regards to free speech and conservative thought. But it's quite intimidating as well.
Did you feel safe all the time?
No. Right. No, but that's not a priority for me. I'm quite hardy. So, you know, if students suss me out, I think one... No, they didn't suss me out, actually. I eventually got thrown out of one of the group chats because someone was like, this person's a bit suspicious. I'm not great with tech, actually. So someone, it's like a WhatsApp channel or something, and someone said that, oh, we had screenshots were taken from your account, so we've had to throw you out the group in case you're spreading information. I said, oh, okay, that's fine. And then a couple of weeks later, this was regards to, I had an event around the documentary Birth Gap, Childless World, about population decline. And it was my event in particular, actually. And so I had a lot of pressure from the college to try and control the protest. And so I messaged the protesters from this number that I had and this persona that I had on the chat and said, by the way, this was me sitting in your group chat for the last 3 weeks. You know, can we talk about managing this so that in a way that we're both happy with the outcome of the night? You get to have your piece, I get to have my piece. But they didn't want to do that.
So your event about the birth rate, so why would people protest that?
So it was a tricky one because it wasn't the documentary maker, Stephen Shaw, that they were necessarily protesting against. What they protested against, the fact that he was involved with myself and Jordan Peterson. He'd recently been on Jordan Peterson's podcast. So it was another one of these politics by cooties kind of thing. You know, he'd been in, you know, had a personal connection with both of us. And so by the same extent, he must be sympathetic towards our views. Therefore, if I'm transphobic and Jordan Peterson's transphobic, then he must be transphobic and this must be a transphobic film, even though none of the students had watched the film before they mounted a protest. But it's the same with these other events. So again, Helen Joyce's event, she was talking about her book, Trans, and none of the students had read it. And no one had watched this documentary, but that doesn't matter. They've decided who you are and that they don't like that. And so it was that guilt by association thing. And even though Stephen's been very open, and if you know, he's got three parts of a documentary, he goes all around the world, and his main message is that anyone who wants to have children should be able to have children and as many children as they'd like. But likewise, he's equally supportive of those who don't want children for whatever reason.
Hard to find any bigotry in that.
Oh, I know. And you know, he doesn't come out and say, and this isn't actually his belief, but he doesn't come out and say, you know, women need to get back in the kitchen, or, you know, children must have a mother and a father, you know, and all that. You know, he's quite egalitarian with regards to his approach to families. You know, he's like, whatever makeup of a family you can get together, good for you. You know, whereas I might take a more sort of traditional view and say, like, the ideal is a mother and a father, and then if you can't, you know, do that for whatever reason, you know, then there's, you know, it's not a good thing to have family, but it's more complicated. But like I said, Stephen's like, if you're gay, if you're trans, if, you know, whatever religion you have, no religion, whatever your background, if you want children, it's kind of your human right, if you have any human rights in this world, to be able to have however many children you want. Apparently that's controversial. but obviously they actually don't, these protesters don't listen long enough to hear that said. And they're not interested in having it said. And this instance was actually quite a revelation to me, because when I was hanging out in these group chats, I saw them planning how they were going to try and take us down from start to finish. And one of the first things they said they were going to do is contact. So I'd contacted all the faculties to say, look, could you put this on your newsletter list? And, you know, these newsletter lists aren't, we encourage you to go and see this because it would be good for your course or whatever, or you have to go and see this because it's relevant to your module. It's just, newsflash, this event is going on. And one of the faculties that had done that was the natural sciences faculty, which I think is right, because population decline has a lot to do with fertility and all these kinds of things, demographics. And so it seemed only right that a faculty like that would put this on their mailing list. So students decided they were going to attack this natural sciences department. And they said that what they were going to accused the faculty of doing was promoting eugenics, even though they knew it wasn't true. They were, you know, they were saying in this chat that they kind of know this is a trumped up charge that's founded upon nothing, but it would scare the faculty enough into apologizing, because they, you know, they said either you're going to get this response from the faculty of, oh, we didn't know, we didn't realize, we're very sorry, or they'll say, well, but my free speech, and so you have to let them do it. And either way, they were going to have a response to this, which was accuse them of promoting eugenics, even though letting anyone and everyone who wants to have kids have kids is somehow genetic cleansing, even though it's a free-for-all. But there you go. But it was a shock to me that they knew that this was a trumped-up charge. And I think the sad thing about that was that there's a handful of ringleaders who concoct these ideas and these strategies, like accusing, you know, us of promoting eugenics. And then there's the sort of followers behind them that are more mentally ill, scared, all the rest of it, and genuinely believe that if they have a trans identity, that the world is out to get them, that the world is trying to stop them from being their true self, to stop them you know, being who they want to be and expressing themselves. They genuinely believe that. And I can sort of say that from my own perspective of, you know, having been very left-wing, sort of radically left-wing. I believe the whole world was out to get me, because I was being told by people who I looked up to who were more powerful than me that the world was out to get me. And so it's just sad that you see these ringleaders who know that they're lying, and they know that I know that they're lying, but they'll lie anyway. But then you've got the people underneath who are just scared for themselves and their, you know, chosen family and their identity, and they're just scared for themselves, and they get dragged along on this and convinced that, you know, I want them dead, or Stephen wants them dead, or Jordan Peterson wants them dead, and it's just not true.
So if we got to this point where they've tried these various ways to cancel the event, but the event's still going ahead, what would happen next?
So the protest is mounted, and you know, I'll work with, on the events that I do work on, with the organiser to get security in place. So that can be, if you're at a college, just additional porters that night, if it's not going to be too big of a deal. If it's going to be a huge kickoff, that means private security and trying to source the funding for that, which the college won't always put up. And so then it becomes a, can we get donations? Free Speech Union are very good at that. They've launched a new program, the Mataget program, which is for things like security when students want to put on an event, but their university says, fine, but you need private security and it's going to cost £400. And they also, you know, have money to launch new societies and all the rest of it. But there's things out there, but it's very difficult. And these things have only come about in the last 18 months. So sometimes security is put in place. In some events, you'll have to arrange back entrances for people to come through, because a lot of these protests will gather at the entrance of the venue.
Right.
And either block the entrance or basically create a corridor to the entrance so that you have to walk through 100 to 150 people with placards screaming, in your face to get into these venues. And so obviously that puts a lot of people off, even like, you know, rugged people who otherwise, you know, have no issue about speaking freely. If you're conscientious at all, it makes you pause. It makes you think twice that maybe I've made a poor judgment here. Maybe this writer has said something that I actually haven't read and didn't know about and don't agree with. And so that's sort of what happens on the night. And these protests will go on the whole time the talk is going on. And so in venues where they can surround the place, they will. And they will use, megaphones, bullhorns, pots and pans, drums, and just try to drown you out for the next 3 hours. It's relentless. And if I think on the recording of the Helen Joyce Q&A, there's a brief moment in which you can hear the sort of mob coming. That was quite an intimidating night, because you could hear this protest of 150 people getting nearer and nearer as people are trying to talk louder and louder over them. And they got right outside the door. So another issue with sort of the safety is that these protesters will block the fire doors and windows, not intentionally to sort of cause a crush or anything if there were to be a fire alarm, but more they're the nearest doors to the building, you know, the venue that you're in. So if they can't be in the room causing, you know, a ruckus, they'll stand as close to being in the room as possible, so the corridors or walkways outside. And so that becomes, you know, a health and safety issue. And then if these protesters do get in the room, and there's more of them than the capacity of the venue, then you can have potential crush situations. And so it's just a logistical nightmare. And so when you hear about venues pulling out for security reasons, sometimes you think, is it ideological? But actually it's really difficult and expensive to mount these things to ensure that events can go ahead.
So that does happen sometimes. The venue wants to have the event, but they just decide they can't.
Mm. Yeah, it's the expense, it's the logistics. And if you're a small venue or a venue with a strict budget, it's not always possible. And so it's sort of with regret that you have to cancel. But I'm sure it's also a load off the people's minds who are thinking, oh God, we only wanted to host this talk and it's turned into, you know, a whole GB News segment and a piece in the Telegraph and whatever. You know, people do get attention that they never expect to doing this.
If students do attend events that are controversial, I mean, do they face repercussions either at the event or in the longer term?
There's two different things that students are most concerned about when engaging in any of this kind of free speech, controversial stuff, and that is social ostracism and career impediment. And so the social ostracism side is a lot of people, particularly in STEM actually, because politics isn't always relevant, their peers and their colleagues may not know that their views. And so they go, oh, Tom's, you know, a great, lovely person, all the rest of it. And then they see Tom going into a venue with someone they've decided is, you know, a racist or whatever. And then ergo, Tom is racist, and I never knew this about Tom. And so now I can't work with Tom and all the rest of it. So that's sort of like the least that can kind of happen, is that people just decide they no longer want to sit with you at lunchtime, and they're sort of sneering at you when you have to work on a project or whatever. But if you have any kind of responsibility, so if you're a supervisor, if you're a lead in the faculty, if you're head of a college, that then could easily become an investigation into whether you're some sort of danger, some sort of, what do you call it, safeguarding issue. And that's what a lot of professors fear when trying to come to these things, because generally it's not undergrads trying to go to these things, it's masters and PhD students, and I think that's something to do with the sort of level of maturity required just to get above that black and white, you know, political mindset that a lot of us have when we're young. So for a lot of them, it's they could be investigated, and they are investigated, and it can take months, and I don't know a single case in which I know a professor that's been investigated that hasn't had all charges dropped against them, but it doesn't stop the issue being raised again in 4 months' time or whatever, because they've been seen at another talk. or if they dare to even, you know, step up and go, actually, no, we should be having these conversations, you know, good luck to you, buddy, because you're going to have the whole faculty raining down on your head. So with regards to career advancement, if you do have master's students or PhD students who maybe have the responsibility issue, but not as much as a head of department, if you're known to have XYZ views, there's the perception that you will be discriminated against. And it's hard to quantify these things because often if you're rejected from something, it will be some other reason of, oh, we're not really interested in that direction of research, or, oh, we don't have the money that you're asking for, or all the rest of it. And so it's hard to say that it's direct discrimination because there will always be another reason why they haven't picked you. But when you talk to the people who are afraid about this, that's what they're listing, is I'll get passed over for a promotion, I won't get a research grant, et cetera, et cetera, if my views are known. And so they don't go to these events or will go ahead of time. So another one of the strategies we use to help with audiences being able to come and listen to the people they want to is set up waiting rooms where people can come hours before the thing starts and sit there and do their work or eat a picnic or whatever beforehand, before the protesters gather, so that they aren't seen coming in and they aren't seen leaving afterwards. So that's another one of the ways in which people can engage with the thoughts that they want to. But it's all sort of risk mitigation for this social ostracism and getting passed over for their career, as well as the having to walk through quite intimidating crowds in which, you know, you do get jostled sometimes, you know, you get unintentionally, you know, knocked in the head or whatever. It can be quite dangerous, and then the whole crush situation, which can happen as well. If you're someone small like me, it's not great when you've got some lumbering people over the top of you. But
if you got to sit down with some of the organisers of the cancellations, what would you say to them?
I've talked to them a few times, because actually in the Stephen Shaw instance, I got asked by the college that had given me the room, basically to control the protest, as if that was my responsibility in the first place and not the responsibility of the organisers. But I reached out to the organisers and I said, look, if you, because the issue the college had with that event, they said, was the noise issue with regards to it was exam season was coming up and whatever. And so we want your event to go ahead, but it's going to be, the protesters are going to be too noisy. And we can't tell the protesters not to protest, because that would be a violation of their rights. I'm like, okay, if it's a violation of my rights not to be able to congregate, to talk to people, and you're also depriving students of their rights to congregate and talk to people. And so I tried to reach out to, well, I did reach out to these the organisers of that particular protest and said, look, the college has basically asked me to make you go away. And I said no, because they have a right to speak as much as I do. And so I've defended your right, and I want you to know that, because I don't hate you, and I don't want you, you know, your lifestyle to be just squeezed out of society, and I don't want you to be social pariahs and all the rest of it. I want you to be, to have as much freedom and integration and all the rest of it as myself. And so I've supported maintaining that for you. Will you do the same in return by just keeping the noise down? And I said, you can, if you want to come in and confront myself and the filmmaker, do. Tickets are free. You're welcome to come. And all they said is, I don't think we can do that. And that's because the rationale in those circles is my existence isn't up for debate, as if that was what was actually going on. And again, having embodied that mindset for many years, like, it feels like that at the time. You know, if someone's contesting your identity, even the smallest amount, is you don't want me to exist. But that's not actually what is going on in those rooms. You know, it's always conversations about how we can better coexist. So it's, what would I say to these protesters in general? I wish I could be more eloquent when I say, get a life, grow. Can I swear?
No.
No. Grow up. and I do kind of mean that in the very literal sense is that it's just infantile. And actually, what I've learned from moving from that very left wing to now a sort of small C conservative position is that everything I was told about all these people, you know, don't want you in society, they don't want you to exist, simply isn't true. Some of them, in fact, almost all the nicest people I've met have been on this conservative side that I've been on. And so both for protesters, if these things go ahead, you realise the world doesn't actually end. In fact, nothing much changes at all, because it's very rare in human history that one great speech changes a society. Normally it's many, 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 many little speeches, little changes to the law, et cetera, that cause a slight movement, you know. And so actually, for these talks to go ahead, almost nothing changes and the world really doesn't end. And I, you know, I want audiences who are afraid to come to the things that they want to come to know that as well, that actually, if you get seen going into a venue, you know, and you come out again and the next day your colleague gives you like the side eye, the world hasn't ended. And I have an issue, you know, getting my friends to see that, because I'm one of the few people who's sort of truly the other side of cancellation. I've dealt with sort of two major cancellation events in the last 3 years, and once you get outside the other side, the first one, you kind of realise you're pretty much invincible. And so when you get into another one, you know the lay of the land. You know that if you just keep, not keep your head down, but sort of dig down and just keep going, it lasts 3 days at the worst. And then you come out the other side and you might have lost a couple of people that they weren't meant to be in your life in the first place. You know, you were having some sort of stilted relationship in which they weren't speaking their mind, you weren't speaking your mind. And then you get a host of new people who go, wow, that was really, you know, courageous, or I really agree with you, good job, let's exchange, you know, business cards.
Do you think it's reasonable to ask you to control the protesters? It seems almost like an impossible task.
I was fuming. I was fuming. It was actually impossible, legally, because the protest was on a public street. And so the college couldn't technically do, well, they couldn't technically do anything because it was outside their property rather than inside their property. So they couldn't move protesters on. It's on a public street, so even the police can't move protesters on unless they're causing significant unrest or blocking a public highway to the extent, you know, like police can't get through, people can't go about their business. You know, and so to ask me to do something that even the police can't do and make that the threshold of the event going on ahead, I still can't quite believe it. You know, I have to go back and look at some of these emails sometimes to remind myself that had actually happened. Because that's what annoyed me most about that cancellation in particular, is that the playing along as if, oh, well, if you can meet these standards, then the event will go ahead because we're not against you and we're not against your event.
You just become more powerful than the police, then you can have your
own. Yeah, exactly. And so these are the little sort of catch-22 situations which aren't accounted for in law.
The universities were always traditionally seen as a chance to kind of learn new ideas, maybe even reinvent yourself a little bit. But now it seems it's a bit more about following an ideology and capturing young minds. And what's it like as a student who refuses to toe the line? Have there been like subcultures developing?
It's liberating, which I think I sort of hinted at in the fact that once you survive a cancellation, you're like, God, I can do anything. but it's for actually a lot of students, it's not, for the reasons I sort of laid out before, this threat of being investigated, losing all of your friends, potentially losing your career opportunities. But there is a subculture emerging. There's a public sort of subculture, and you can only really call it a subculture because it's not as popular or influential as the dominant culture. But it's not underground by any means. So there's initiatives like the Battle of Ideas and Living Freedom. So that's sort of Claire Fox and her free speech work, and Alistair Donald sort of heads up the Academy of Ideas. And they're good for maintaining that, reiterating the liberal free speech paradigm we've kind of lived in since the 1970s, 80s, in which you say your piece, I'll say my piece, we can agree to disagree and walk away again. And actually, again, it's not the end of the world. We can agree to disagree and then still have a drink in the pub. And they're trying to revive that culture and remind, pass that heritage down, that those values down. And they particularly engaging young people in that. So they're going out into universities. So some of the events, the first Living Freedom events, took place at Cambridge. And I worked with Alistair on that. And they're good for undergrads, I think, who are perhaps nervous, but are more left-wing, but maybe feel like they're not completely left-wing in the prescribed way of you have to agree with all the identity politics. If you have a nuanced point on one, you know, that's not allowed. But actually in these Living Freedom spaces, it is. Living Freedom's good in particular because what that is about. They were billed as free speech classes by the Times, I think, and that's not true. But they're not prescriptive in that way. But what they do is get a public figure to pick a historic figure of what they said on free speech. It might be what has Locke said on free speech, what has Milton said on free speech. Generally, we're picking Western intellectual figures because we're in the West, and actually that's, you know, Western intellectuals is what we don't talk about much anymore, though I think anyone's free to sort of propose any kind of intellectual figure, but generally we're looking at the Western heritage of where the foundation of free speech comes from and why it's considered a right now, what's the paradigm that led up to it being enshrined that way. And we'll get the public figure to talk about the historic figure and how their ideas perhaps translate onto today or don't, and are these free speech arguments useful or not. But with regards to the subculture, the unspoken stuff, like the sort of, you know, the talks that are public, but actually you have to be invited because you don't want the whole room to be filled up with protesters just screaming at the, you know, the public, the speaker for you know, hours because it's not productive or fun, and no one would agree to speak. But then there's what I alluded to in my most recent article in the Critic magazine, which is these secret societies that are springing up. So you have sort of debating societies, which are broadly speaking like listed among the societies within universities. So Royal Holloway did have a good debating society that then sort of got taken down, but there's a group of students there trying to revive that. And so they're not, you know, dominant culture. It's not the speaking union of the university, but they're maintaining that free, the decorum of the free speech space in a way that the speaking unions aren't. And so that's its own kind of miniature culture in which, again, it's kind of invite only. Right. But you can say anything you want in those spaces. So again, it's not, we choose you and you and you because you agree with us. It's just, do you believe in free speech? Basically, no holds barred. Yes, okay, fine. But then there's the really like subculture, which is you don't know these societies exist. And you have to know someone who's in the society who recommends you, or you sort of get picked out from the crowd, invited, vetted. And it all sounds very sort of surreptitious, and this is where we hide the worst of our opinions, but it's more that they're very ordinary, borderline boring conversations. They're classroom conversations that you can't have in the classroom. So it's like, okay, I want to look at the intersection of you know, Locke and Rousseau. Actually, you're not going to have that conversation in the classroom unless it's within the paradigm of identity politics. If I want to talk about how that relates to Aristotle, maybe we'll have like a, you know, a 20-minute discussion in class, but it does not get deep. It doesn't, we don't have any conversations about the bearing that it has on the West and its trajectory. And so this is what the conversations that are going on in these societies. It's like I said in the article, it's not for a, you know, when people hear secret societies, Cambridge has had all sorts of secret societies and so has Oxford. I think there's that play by is it Laura Wilde, maybe? I can't remember her name, but it's called Posh Boys, and it was turned into a film, and it was about, you know, these Etonian boys who had these, you know, secret societies which were all, you know, sex and you know, trashing a place and getting blind drunk and all the rest of it. Decline and Fall, I think Evelyn Waugh depicted a similar thing. So that's what people think when they hear of Oxbridge secret societies, and I think a few of those still go on, but they're sort of so taboo now, they've just given up. But actually it's not for a love of these sort of scandalous, you know, crazy ideological groups that are existing. It's people who love G.K. Chesterton and C.S. Lewis who want to, you know, read you know, Nietzsche, God forbid, and talk about it. And that's the subculture. And those spaces are really good for giving people confidence again, that these things aren't heretical, they aren't radical, they're what we were all talking about in the common room of the university up until about 2010. And so it's reviving that traditional university culture again within the students themselves, so that then they can perhaps go into the classroom and go, well, actually, I've read this other text which wasn't on the reading list and kind of contradict what you're saying. What do you think about that?
And some of the academics I've spoken to about cancel culture talked about their colleagues having to self-censor for the sake of their career. Does that exist among students as well?
Yeah, again, it's sort of you're choosy about who you're publicly seen talking to. These societies, you know, that half the reason they're invite only is, and that they're secret, is because you don't want someone going out and going, oh, well, I saw so-and-so talking about this and this. Oh, isn't that horrific? That's why these societies are secret, and that's why you are choosy about who you go into venues with. But yeah, it's difficult. For myself, I was told at different junctures by about three or four different supervisors the topics that I wanted to write essays on for sort of my final grade marking. If I was to write on those subjects, I wouldn't do well. I might do okay, you know, I'll pass. They're not going to actively discriminate against me. But one of the papers I wrote was on Sherlock Holmes and how he's actually a man of faith, and the intersection of faith and logic mediated by imagination. So I thought that was quite an interesting subject. But if I'd have written a paper on why Sherlock Holmes is gay and why Watson is gay and why they're gay for each other, you know, if you get, you know, a particularly ideological academic who hasn't had lunch yet, who's got, you know, why Sherlock Holmes is gay versus why Sherlock Holmes is in fact a religious man, and you're interested in queer theory, you're going to be zipping through that going, oh yes, brilliant, yes. Mm-hmm. If you're faced with that and it's not your bag, and actually you really hate ideas like that, you're going to go, that punctuation mark's out of place, missed a comma there, that, you know, got two letters the wrong way around there, you flipped the date round on that citation wrong, -1, you know, so it's not necessarily, you know, I can't testify that that's what's going on, but it's what is certainly sensed and what people fear. And I did write one essay on why something is particularly gay and did very well. And then this one on faith didn't do so well. Maybe I'm just not so good at writing on faith, who knows? But that was sort of neither here nor there for me, because I'm not looking for, you know, career advancement in academia. And so that's, for some people, that's the end of the world. You know, my dad's like, are you sure you want to do this? Are you sure you want to do this? I'm like, yeah, it's fine. Because there's so much more at stake there. And I think this is the difficulty that people have, is that for me, there was so much more at stake there than a grade or a future career. It was my integrity. It was my self-respect. It was my freedom. It was my independence. All of these things I place far more emphasis on than a grade or even future security. because I don't want to be sitting in a palace and then thinking, but I can't say what I think is true. Some people can, boo for you. But because the economy for future years is going to be uncertain, this is a big concern for a lot of people. And again, that's where class comes into it, right? Because those who have the luxury of going, well, actually, mum and dad can prop me up, and actually, I've been sitting on this fund for the last 25 years, which I can now take out and subsist off of whatever. But if you're middle class or working class, doing yourself out of career advancement, which you've already paid through the nose to get, is a big decision. And I understand why most people don't take it.
We saw the higher education bill come in, which was great, but do you think that will make a difference to the culture among the students?
No, and I had my own small part in the formulation of that bill. I sat down with a few people involved and they asked my opinion on what they think the issue is and what can be done to resolve it. And I wasn't very happy with the outcome of that piece of legislation. I mean, I'm glad there's something now, and that I think the act of being noisy about the need for a law has done more than the law will itself. Quite ironically, on the night that got passed for Royal Assent in the House of Lords was the night that my event with Stephen Shaw got cancelled, and we were hiding in an office, attic office room. One of the colleges that an academic who should remain nameless gave us to continue speaking with students on that night. And so whilst we were all squeezed into this room talking about population decline in secret, Claire Fox was standing up in the House of Lords going, the fact that this is happening is the reason we need this law. Unfortunately, I don't know what it will do to help things like that stop happening. I mean, that was quite an extreme instance. But the problem is that the universities have to want to implement their own free speech rules. So it's not that we don't have free speech laws, and it's not that the universities don't have free speech rules, in which if you sign up to be a member of the university, you have to follow, or technically you can be thrown out if you keep violating these rules, which so many of the protesters are. Is that the universities don't want to enforce them in the first place, because I think they probably believe that these rules are too much hassle for their own good. It's one of those things, that'll be a good idea, and then in practice they think, oh God, what have we signed up to? And so I don't like the financial penalty side of the bill, which is sort of mainly what it's, the main thing that it's for, is sort of a big club to say to the universities, do it or we're gonna hammer you. And so I think that will be enough to make them grit their teeth and put in the minor measures that they need to, like having a fund for security to have certain events go ahead. So the place I have hope in is that if more events do go ahead, people will see what I said earlier, which is the world doesn't in fact end for audiences or for protesters. Things just keep going on the way they were, and actually people just feel a bit more content that they have had their voice heard. Even if nothing happens of it, they can go back to bed and go, yeah, I said my piece. And so I think it's going to take a long time. If cultural change will come, it will be because people see that actually you can just meet fire with fire. And so if you don't like someone who's come to talk, fine, go and protest and then set up your own counter talk. That's far more productive than trying to shut down one half of the debate.
What changes would you like to see?
In universities and in general, it's difficult because someone like me gets accused of pulling the ladder up behind them, but I'd actually see less universities, if I'm honest. I don't think it's a conducive environment for a lot of people for just spiritual reasons. It's become such a corporate thing, and if you're going there for self-betterment, you're not going to get it unless it just so happens that your particular set of beliefs and academic interests fall in line with identity politics. But the problem with that is, what's okay to say and not okay to say within identity politics is having some sort of major change every year. So it's, okay, we've got this new pride flag, and actually we don't say, you know, people of colour anymore. We say, black people with a capital B, or whatever it is. You know, something will change, and what was okay to say last week is not okay to say this week. And actually, if your opinion hasn't changed with everyone else, suddenly you're on the outside crowd when you were on the in crowd, and it's rough. And you know, students are getting set up with these false hopes that you know, if they do some sort of degree, it's going to give them a leg up. And it's difficult because there's the sort of millennial generation and before, university was still this thing where it was a huge leg up. You know, your starting salary would be, you know, 5, maybe even 10 years ahead of someone who, you know, comes in at it without a degree and has to work their way up. And so it really was how the working class, you know, if you think the grammar school generation, lifted themselves up into the middle class if they'd been stuck in the working class for decades. You know, like my family was, my dad went to a grammar school, came from a mining family. You know, I come from a family of coal miners, military men, factory workers. And my family had been that unceasingly for centuries. I can track my lineage back. You know, every male on my dad's side was a coal miner. The first person not to do that was his dad, just because the coal mines closed, his coal mine closed in the 60s, and so he went into a factory and then he went into the military. And my dad went to a grammar school and then he went into the military, and that combined together gave them that kind of upward mobility that meant that when he had children, me and my sister, it wasn't, okay, well, you're just going to go and work in the local village as, you know, the coal sorter, or, you know, working on the looms or whatever, you know, in the factory, or even just be a shop girl. You know, it's like, you can, if you want to do that, that's fine. But if you want to go and do something else, that's possible. But that generation, it's hard to make them see now that university doesn't do that. All it does is saddle you with a huge debt, and then you have to start at square one like everyone else as well. So it's those who just bypass university and go in for square one. But if I was going to be really radical, actually, about what I'd do about universities, is people don't, unless you want to be a doctor or an engineer where you actually need a degree to get ahead, I'd make it the culture that you don't go to university until later life. It might even just be like your end of your 20s. But you know, one of the other things I'm passionate about is population decline, and what we're seeing is more and more young people put off starting families, starting long-term committed relationships, because they go, I need to get to a certain place in my career first, because they kind of got a sunk cost. Is it a fallacy? Who knows? In university, that, no, I have to get this job, and then, oh God, I've been offered a partner and now I can do this. And then they're 35 and they go, oh God, I haven't actually got a wife yet, husband yet. And, oh God, my fertility window is that narrow now. And it might not even be possible, because we're lied to about, you know, fertility. It sort of tails off at, you know, around 40. It doesn't, it starts tailing off around 30. So I'd change the culture that if lots of people want to go to university to better themselves for no other reason than sort of better themselves, or they're already in a career and that workplace fosters that development by paying for their degrees or whatever, great. But I think I myself would have benefited. I already went to university late. I went at 21, and that made a world of difference than if I went at 18. But if I'd have gone at my age now, I'd view it even differently again and value it differently. And so that's... yeah, I don't know. Don't make me Prime Minister, because I will just get rid of them all.
Charlie Bentley-Astor, thank you for joining us.
Thank you.